Okay, my name is Jennifer Garcia, and I am at William H. Turner Technical Arts High School, the Twisted Pencil, on February 14, 2006, to interview Jeannie Teeny, the name about his or her personal history of his childhood.
My name is Andre Kirkland. I am at the William H. Turner Technical Arts High School, Twisted Pencil, on February 14, 2006, to interview Gene Timmings on his childhood.
My name is Kyle Wright. I am at William H. Turner Technical Arts High School, Twisted Pencil Room. I am here to interview Gene Tenney about his personal history.
Okay. Describe when and where you were born and a bit about your parents and your grandparents.
Okay. I was born in the South Bronx in New York City. Both my parents are from the Caribbean. My mom was from Jamaica. My father from Guyana in South America. And they met in New York several years earlier. So it took two people coming from two different places to a third place. And I grew up most of, until I was a junior in high school in New York City. And then my family relocated to Long Island, which was very rural, and a radical change from New York City. And that's where I think I became an environmentalist, because I could appreciate all the wildlife and all that good stuff.
And when you moved to Miami, you continued school here in?
Oh no, I moved to Miami many years later. I moved to Miami in 1974. By that time, I had lived in Los Angeles and in Europe and in Boston and, you know, and all of that. But in the 3 decades or so since I've come to Miami, I've seen it change quite a bit.
What part of town did you move to when you moved to Miami?
My first landfall in Miami was in South Miami. Mm-hmm. And then I relocated to Coconut Grove. I lived in the Grove for about 8 years, and then moved to, Biscayne Boulevard and 31st Street, whatever that's called now. And now I live in, some people call it Buena Vista West, others call it Little Haiti, but that area.
Can you describe some of your early memories of Miami?
Early memories of Miami, of course, it's not the same as memories of early Miami, mm-hmm. but certainly my first memory, the day I got here, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, had a building in downtown Miami, which had a rooftop garage, which collapsed that day mm-hmm. from the weight of the cars. And the following day, President Nixon resigned. So that was my arrival in Miami. And at the time, it was much less, as they say, developed. Okay, you had, I believe, what is now the SunTrust building might have been the tallest building in downtown. Mm-hmm. And there were, as I'm thinking, just much more open space, perhaps. It was different. It was Coconut Grove, which I came to know pretty well, was this really interesting, precious enclave of, you know, Bahamian descendants and so forth. And we had a group. There was a group there called the Miami Black Arts Workshop, which was basically African-American visual artists. And I joined them, and that became a very strong bond and just a great experience, bringing art to the people and the people to art and all of that. What else can I say about Miami was still going through its I don't know what to even call it. There was kind of the old Miamians who still weren't very comfortable with the large Spanish-speaking presence, and you had folks, you know, wanting to oppose bilingualism and all of that, you know.
When coming to Miami in 1974, were things for black people like still segregated, or it was, everything was open to inclusion?
No, segregation was over. But interestingly enough, whereas in any other part of the South, you would have heard that being described as something positive. Here in Miami, I was kind of surprised that a lot of people had very fond memories of when it was still segregated. It turns out that unlike other parts of the South, the section of Miami called Overtown, right near downtown, which was part of the original city, colored town, was very thriving, very prosperous, had, you know, black-owned hotels and all of this. And people pretty much said that the two things, that the construction of the expressway, which just destroyed a lot of that community, and integration had actually destroyed some of that. So it was a really an interesting twist. But, of course, on the, by the same token, you just didn't have those restrictions. I mean, I grew up in the North. I'm not going to say that there wasn't prejudice and discrimination up North, but we didn't have anything like, you know, colored waiting rooms and so forth. I mean, I don't know how I would have reacted to, you know, having to go to a colored drinking fountain or something like that.
Going back to early childhood days, what did you intend to do in your adult years for a profession?
I think I was one of those who was officially undecided for a long time. But by the time I got to junior, senior year in high school, I think I pretty much decided that I was going to try to pursue dentistry as a career. It I can't say altogether why it looked like something I could handle. It would look like a profession that might be less demanding than being a doctor, but still challenging and specialized enough. And, you know, I imagine those who have artistic temperament who like to work with their hands and so forth, the idea of, you know, creating you know, recreating natural shapes and caring for, you know, people's dental health was appealing. After I got into college and realized that, well, there were other things that I might have been a little better suited for, I kind of switched off to that, which was foreign language. But I think as a youth, I must have gone through wanting to be just about everything at one point or another.
What do you remember about local or national efforts to bring full civil rights to black Americans?
Naturally, I was, as you can tell from the gray beard, I was around long enough to have been here when the Brown versus Board of Education decision was handed down, and watching kind of from a distance, because in the North, like I said, this was something we were reading about in the newspapers. I mean, the integration of Little Rock High School, I mean, federal troops and the governor standing up and defying the law. And I mean, this was a whole different sense for us of how life in America should have been. I had heard stories from schoolmates, classmates, who very often would go south in the summertime, you know, spend time in the country with their relatives. And you know, it sounded just very strange to me then that, oh, you mean because you're colored, you don't get the same service as somebody who's white? It was, but I mean, it's one thing for that to be just done by ignorant people. But once the law changes, then you expect that the people who are supposed to be about the law, the governors, the law enforcement, would be upholding it. And it was a real reality check to see that that wasn't happening. And then, of course, from there, we watched the whole movement under Dr. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X coming on the scene, the Nation of Islam, and all of that segued into what was called the Black Consciousness Movement. So it was in New York, we didn't have that kind of raw, naked segregation, but it was there. I mean, you couldn't just move into any neighborhood you wanted. You you encountered, if you went into certain neighborhoods, you might not be received very warmly, and, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, nothing official.
How did your school handle the effort to integrate?
Well, here again, growing up in the North, we were integrated all along. But then, yeah, the South Bronx at that time, some people called it the beautiful Bronx. In the like 1940s, 50s, the Bronx was like the promised land. And people, I mean, on my block, everybody was there. There was Black, it was Italian, it was Jewish, there was, you know, white people from the South, there were, and, you know, everybody, we played, that was it, that was how it was. So, and that carried over into the, naturally into the schools. For a portion of the time I went to Catholic school, by the time I got to high school, that's when, you know, I could see that, okay, there were some things, like, for example, there was supposed to be, you know, this, you know, between the Irish and the, you know, groups that didn't quite always get along, but it was kind of minor, because, I mean, the thing was we were all there together, so, you know, so, yeah.
Did you ever suffer any haunting memory of discrimination or separation of the races?
I've been trying to give that one some thought. I'll tell you, the only haunting memory that I can think of came much later, after, you know, long after I was out of school, and this is one that's still a mystery to me. My brother, my cousin, and I went to Canada. We just, you know, it's our big adventure. We're gonna drive from New York to Montreal and Toronto, you know, we're leaving the country. And, well, you know, we had heard that things in Canada were just a little more mellow. People didn't have all that. And sure enough, I mean, there it was. I can't say it was altogether absent, but generally speaking, you walked into a store or something, I mean, you were just another customer walking into a store. You know, you didn't have people with that on guard and all that kind of thing that we had been used to. The strange part was we had gone from Montreal to Toronto, and then we came back across through Niagara Falls. And somehow, when we got to Niagara Falls, we knew we were back in the States. The whole racial thing was back. And from that day to this day, I cannot tell you what it was. I have gone back over there and said, what was it that we saw or heard or felt, but it was, you just knew. And what made that haunting was that there was something so invisible that at the same time was so present and so absolutely there. And I mean, if it was just me, I would, but then, you know, all three of us were, I mean, just knew it. We knew it. So that in the category of haunting memories, I think that's the one that would do it, you know?
When you came in 1974, there was the many assassinations occurring just right before. What was your response to Martin Luther King's murder in 1968? Well, why don't you pass that? But I have something else. So can I keep talking?
Stay outside. Tell me to be quiet.
Stop.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It stopped. While growing up with great leaders such as Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, what was your response to their assassination?
Well, the assassination of John Kennedy in 63, I think, changed the whole country and I wouldn't say prepared us for other assassinations, but then when others came, it was not as shocking, although it was very devastating, of course. I mean, you know, the fact that Malcolm was killed by black people was, that one was a heavy one for everybody. I mean, Martin Luther King, I was actually out of the country when that happened. I was doing graduate work in Europe. I was in Holland, in Amsterdam, going to visit friends, I mean, just enjoying life. And got to Amsterdam and was asking directions, and this guy decided to show me, you know, walk with him to where I needed to go. And on the way, I casually asked, I said, I noticed all the flags were at half-mast. And, you know, I'm thinking somebody in the royal family must have passed. And he said, well, that's for Martin Luther King. I said, for Martin Luther King? He said, he was assassinated yesterday. Well, you know, that was just one of those little, excuse me, I think I need to just go sit down. Dr. King's assassination, and it, we'll just have to ignore that. A little background music to the, okay. It launched riots all over the place, mainly because, I mean, in a way you could say, well, that was horrible because it just sort of said that the forces of violence had triumphed over his whole vision of nonviolence. But it was just the anger that, I mean, here was a man of peace who had actually spared the nation all kinds of turmoil and grief by insisting on nonviolence when things could have gone another way. And that his reward that was being murdered, that was, you know, pretty... I mean, it's still, I think, felt that way. Yeah. And then, of course, Robert Kennedy was killed only weeks after him, so it was that kind of time.
Was there any effect on civil rights in Miami associated with the wave of the Cubans that came to Miami in the 1960s? And what do you remember hearing about Castro and the Cuban Missile Crisis?
The situation, of course, coming here in 1974, I'm really kind of getting a lot of this stuff after the fact. I was in New York as the Cuban Missile Crisis developed. I mean, the fact that it was New York's Senator Keating who first brought to light the presence of these Soviet missiles in Cuba made it even more of a story there. Somehow, maybe it was just naive on my part, but you know, in retrospect, you know, we kept saying this is the closest the world actually came to nuclear war. It just never seemed to me that that situation could escalate to the point where it would actually turn into that. It just didn't, I mean, it just wasn't that. I mean, come on, what are you, you know,
yeah.
What are you going to attack the United States from Cuba? Come on, this isn't, you know. But you had egos and all that ideology that kind of just ratcheted things up to a high level of tension. As for the, I've been privileged to meet like some of the Cuban families that first came. And it's interesting that when they first got here, they had to go to Virginia Key Beach because they were, you know, y'all are colored, y'all, you know. And they were warmly welcomed and blended right in and loved the place. And one of the fallouts of the whole thing is that, you know, the benefits and the gains that did come out of the civil rights movement were able to benefit, you know, lots of immigrants that came who otherwise, you know, might not have had as easy a time coming into the country.
Okay, last question. Describe what you remember about hearing about the 68 riots in Liberty City.
Only that it was pretty devastating. It was. I mean, what I heard was that the degree of anger and just was so extreme. When I got here, Martin Luther King Boulevard was, Northwest 62nd Street had been renamed, it was being reconstructed as Martin Luther King Boulevard. And as we speak today, that is still, we in the artist community are still looking at ways to make that boulevard be very significant, be a living memorial. Tell younger generations, because everybody born after 68 has no real idea who Dr. King was, what this was about, and what, you know, wasn't just about one man, it was about a whole movement, and a vision, and a potential for the country.
Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
We'd like thank to thank you. You for coming out to Turn the Tape.
And I thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you.
Okay.